Happy belated birthday.
Oh, thank you.
What marks the turning of this season for you this year?
Well, where I live, nothing.
You're in California?
Yes. We're on the central coast in Carmel Valley, which is south, a little bit south of Monterey. And what marks the turning of the season in California is the rain. And the season has already turned from rain to dry. So now we're just waiting for more rain. And that's the only thing. The hills are brown and the trees are waiting, and we are too.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jane Smiley, who was the keynote speaker at the 2017 Montana Book Festival. Together, we'll be talking about her career, including elements of craft, and her welcome advice for writers of all genres. This program contains adult language and themes. Listener discretion is advised. You begin your craft book, 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel, by addressing the run of good authors who have birthdays in late September, including F. Scott Fitzgerald, William Faulkner, T.S. Eliot, William Blake. And then you write...
There's some musicians, too.
Yeah. Who are the musicians?
I wish I could remember.
Gershwin was in there, right?
Yeah, Gershwin is... I think he's the 26th also.
Your birthday twin.
But, you know, the funny thing is, if you type in, at least in the UK, they have this thing that you can find out what are the most common birthdays. And September 26th is statistically the most common birthday in the UK. And it has to be because people had too much to drink on Christmas. And
so 9 months from the
9 months. Oh, my God. And I remember when, I guess it was my second, all my children are same time of year as I am. And I think, I can't remember which one it was, but one of them was born. And there was no room in the nursery for her because there were so many babies. So she was out in the hall with some of the other kids. I always said that was because it was a very snowy year in Iowa. And what else did anybody have to do?
Exactly. So. I love it. You wrote the craft book following the September 11th attacks. The book in part came to be because you faced an artistic dry spell. When you look in the rearview mirror about that time, what does it look like to you?
Well, there's the personal aspect and then there's the political aspect. So the personal aspect is that as a result of the attacks, I decided I wasn't going to read anything that was current. I was going to read stuff that was really, really old. So I started with The Tale of Genji, and then I went on to a few Icelandic sagas. And what I realized as I was reading those old things, which I wanted to get away from the modern world, was that they were all about conflict. They were all about the inability of people to get along with one another. And they all were much more similar to one another than they were different from one another. So what started out as a form of hiding out for me ended up as a kind of re-education in the nature of the novel and in what novels there were. And there are plenty of them that I had never read before. Mm-hmm. And it became totally fascinating to me. So for me, the re-education was a way to get back to writing the novel that I was working on at the time. Now, it was a common thing among writers after September 11th that we looked at our work and we said, this is pointless. You know, how can we address what's actually going on? And yet to go back and read all those novels, some of which have incredibly powerful conflicts in them, I realized that this had been a way that people over the centuries had been addressing the terrifying conflicts of the world that they lived in. And one of the things that I understood about it was that at first the conflict that you're looking at seems impossible and crazy and non-understandable. But then when you write about it, what you have to do is set up a narrative, and a narrative is naturally based on cause and effect. And so once you set up the narrative and you understand the cause and effect, then it may still be horrifying to you, but at least it makes sense, at least it's logical, and so you can go past it. And so one of the things I wanted to do in my latest set of books, which is the Last 100 Years trilogy, was to do a narrative of what's happened in our world from the point of view of one family from 1920 to 2019. And I didn't want to privilege any particular period, so I decided that formally it was going to be 1 year at a time. And even if the years were terribly dramatic, that year was going to be the same length as a year that was not terribly dramatic. And what that gave me the sense of was that time just passes. You know, our inner life, we go boom, 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 and things seem huge and small and huge and small. But the passage of time makes everything disappear. And that was interesting to me, too. So I guess when I was finished with the trilogy, I was a little more philosophical about events.
About your own theory of creativity, you write, the first and the last rules were, get on with it. That's a far cry in my mind from maybe some of the meticulous rituals writers talk about, whether it's how they grind their coffee or the sticks of incense they light. And I'm just wondering, where does this sort of non-avoidant pragmatism come from in you?
Well, it comes from once you've written a number of books, you understand that what you think as the book is going on, you know, your own judgment of your own work is probably wrong. So you have to get all the way to the end of a draft and then reread it and understand, oh, I didn't think that part was going to work, but that's pretty interesting. And that part I thought was going to work, but it's just boring. You also have to understand that there, in the first draft especially, what you're doing a lot of the time is just talking to yourself about stuff that you don't know yet. And so you babble on and on about it. For me, the signal, when I'm rereading a draft, the signal that I was just babbling on and on is the word just. Mary and Bill just couldn't think of anything to say. Well, why put the just in there? Well, that's just a tick on my part. So if there's a passage with the word just in there a few times, I know that I was just sort of talking to myself. And I'm not going to judge myself about that because I know that it's essential to use the rough draft to find your way. And sometimes you're going to go off the path and come back. And sometimes you're going to find a new path and you're going to think, oh, I like that path better. And so you have to be forgiving, self-forgiving, and you have to avoid judging your work as you're writing it. And then when you come back and do the next drafts, you have to be analytical about what it is rather than judgmental. You know, you can indulge in the idea of saying, oh, this is a piece of shit, but you don't want to let that stop you. You have to ask yourself, if that's my instinct, my instinctive response, then what exactly is wrong with it and how can I fix it? And, you know, everybody's situation in life is different. And you just have to make the best of that. But you have to be non-judgmental about your own work as it's progressing. That's how you produce.
Jane, will you read us about who is a novelist from your book?
Sure. The novel has an author. The desire to write a novel is the single required prerequisite for writing a novel. It is the only thing that overcomes all the handicaps. Perfectionism, low self-esteem, depression, alcoholism, diseases of all kinds, immense riches, economic hardship, deadly enemies, the resistance of relatives and friends, laziness, retarded professional development, the regular responsibilities of adulthood, even imprisonment. Sir Thomas Malory, for example, wrote the romance proto-novel Le Morte d'Arthur while imprisoned during the Wars of the Roses. While the desire to write a novel does not guarantee that the resulting novel will be a good one, or if it is, that the author will produce a string of good ones, it is the only way to begin. Most often it grows out of a compulsive habit of reading as a child. It was said of Sinclair Lewis that he was always doing two things at once, and one of them was reading a book. Charles Dickens was an avid reader as a boy. His dearest childhood memories were of reading the tales of the Arabian Nights. I read in preference to almost every other activity, although I didn't read anything respectable. I liked the Bobbsey twins and Nancy Drew. The Brontes, living in a solitary Yorkshire parsonage with a very eccentric father, not only read compulsively, but also wrote compulsively, and had composed many hundreds of pages by their late teens. Undoubtedly, we were reading for all the wrong reasons. Escape, pleasure, avoidance of responsibilities and human contact. We were reading because it was easy and fun, and because we were unsupervised. We were reading to find companions more congenial than those around us. We wanted to fill our heads with nonsense and tune out practical considerations. We were not most likely athletic or useful sorts of children. We were reluctant to help around the house or to go outside and play. We did not have very good manners because, in numerous ways to be cited later, reading books is deleterious to good manners. We did not have good sleep habits, because if we had, we would not have read under the bed covers with a flashlight or held the book up to the moon that shone through the window and ruined our eyes. We were reading because we had two lives, an inner life and an outer life, and they were equally important to us and equally vivid. A novelist is someone whose inner experience is as compelling as the details of his or her life. Someone who may owe more to another author never met than to a close relative seen every day. A novelist has two lives, a reading and writing life, and a lived life. He or she cannot be understood at all apart from this.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Jane Smiley about her prolific writing life. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Has allowed you to avoid the pitfalls that you mentioned, perfectionism, low self-esteem, depression, alcoholism, diseases, riches, economic hardship. What is it?
Well, partly it's luck. Partly I always say to my son, who's quite like me, he's sort of like who I would be as a boy. And he just had his birthday too. And I often say to him, we should write a book called The Blessings of ADD. One of the blessings of ADD is that you're very focused on what it is you want to do. It's not that you have attention deficit. It's that you attend to what you want to do rather than what everybody else wants you to do. It's almost instinctive to do that. And I don't know where it comes from, and I don't know why I have it. But I am sure that if I was in school now, I'd be diagnosed with ADD. And so even though I was a pretty good student, I liked to read what I liked to read. And I did well on some tests if they were about things that I was interested in, and did poorly in some things, which is like math, which I wasn't at all interested in. And I just couldn't help myself. So having ADD is a form of being very self-directed. And that's just the way I was. As far as things like alcoholism or drugs, I'm one of those people who drinks a half a glass of wine and is ready to go to sleep, you know? So why bother? There's no reason to do it. And the things I like to do are to cook, to ride horses, to write books and to read books, and to knit, you know. So of all those things, only riding horses is dangerous. And I do my best to avoid the dangers. And, you know, you could poke yourself in the eye with your knitting needle, but it's highly unlikely.
Especially if you have glasses.
Especially if you have glasses.
I'm so glad you brought up horses, because when I was sitting with this statement about desire, desire is the only reason, right, to keep writing. I want to know about your desire to be in the world of horses.
Well, that probably is one of my earliest desires, because as far as I know, it predates anything else. I know that when my mother and I were living in St. Louis, my mother was working at the St. Louis Globe-Democrat, and my grandmother was taking care of me. And when I was in kindergarten, the trip between my grandmother's house and my mother's house went past a little pony ride place that was on the corner. And what they would do was they'd get the pony out and they'd strap you in, and then they'd send the pony around this little maze at the trot. And because you were strapped in, you had this pleasure of going kind of fast, you know? But it wasn't painful, and wasn't scary because you couldn't fall off. And I hounded her to let me do the pony rides all the time. And if that was where it was started, I don't know. But it just stuck with me after that. I loved the way they looked. I loved the way they acted. I loved the feel of riding. I was a sucker for all those stories where, you know, the horse was your best friend. And then I grew up and had horses and realized that horses do connect. And they do have a feeling for you that you can help. They can be your friend. And that's the greatest pleasure, is understanding the idiosyncrasies of an individual horse, understanding where they came from, understanding how to modify them. The horse I ride now is a mare that I bred. She's 12 now. And she is quite an interesting mare. And she's very alert, but she tends to also get scared of things. And my local vegetarian Buddhist cowboy trainer told me that I had to redirect. So I thought only your local vegetarian cowboy Buddhist trainer would say the word redirect, you know. But it was really effective, because he said what she does is she sees something, her ears prick, then she stares at it. And the longer she stares at it, the more likely she is that she's going to think this is dangerous. Mm-hmm. And if you say to yourself or to her, redirect and turn her head away, then she'll look somewhere else. And I thought, well, this is exactly sort of like obsessive compulsive disorder, you know? So one of the things that interests me about horses is that they have these inner lives. And for many eons, they have not been accredited with having inner lives, but they're actually very smart and they're quite emotionally sophisticated. And if you understand their inner lives and how they can be shaped, then you and that horse can get along. And to me, that's the most fascinating thing. I don't care about showing. I don't care about much else in the horse world, but I care about connecting with the horses and enjoying the pleasure of riding them.
And I love the inherent metaphor of maybe the rider at the desk, you know, in terms of redirecting away from the fear of facing the blank page.
That's true.
I actually have a question that comes from one of our listeners, Kristen Holland, who's up in Eureka, Montana, about the process of researching for Horse Heaven. How did you go about that process?
Well, I had to go look at all sorts of horse racetracks,
that
right?
So awful.
Oh, isn't that so? And then to France, are you kidding me? And to England and to Ascot and, oh my goodness, you know. What a torture.
So do you let yourself, it sounds like, orient towards what intrigues you, what is pleasurable, what?
Well, the horse stuff is separate, because I always loved horses. And one of my memories from when I had a horse in high school was that the owner of the barn where the horse lived would take the kids sometimes over to a racetrack in Illinois. And I think I went twice. And then he wintered the horses over in the barn. And when they were ready in the spring or in the late winter, he would stick the kids on the horses and we would just walk them up and down the aisles. And so I knew it existed. And I knew it was an interesting world. And I knew it was a suspect world, too, which makes it even more interesting. And I knew it wasn't all National Velvet or anything like that. But the other things, I just get interested. I don't know. I'm just a curious person. That comes from a history of reading.
It seems like in this book, 13 Ways of Looking at a Novel, that you also write about receptivity, that there's a planfulness to writing, but also this sense that if you put yourself at the right place at the right time, maybe every day or maybe, you know, in a disciplined fashion, it will come. Does that resonate?
Well, I'm one of those writers like Dickens or Trollope or some of the others who just do it. And the reason is that I think that there's a difference between pleasure and addiction. An addiction is something you really want to do and then you feel bad after. And a pleasure is something that you're too lazy to do, but you feel good after it for some reasons, whatever reasons they are. And I think you should engage in those pleasures. I also think if you're a novelist, you have to keep going in order to retain your sense of what's actually happening, because if you let your self-judgment stop you or make you put stuff away, then you'll forget what's going on. But to me, the most important thing is that, say to yourself, I'm going to write 1,000 words today or 1,000 words every day, 5 days a week. When you get to word 750, you might think, gosh, what next? And then you look around the room and you see some little thing that you could stick in there. And so you stick that in there and all it does for the moment is let you keep going. But then you come back to it the next day when you reread what you wrote today in order to go on and you think, wow, that's really interesting. So I always think every word or every new idea is either a firecracker or a pebble. If it's a pebble, then it's just sitting there doing its job of making it progress. But if it's a firecracker, it could be an inspiration. It could send you in a different direction. Now, one of the things about novels is that there's an energy in the novel. If the energy is always pointing directly in one direction toward the thing you planned, then it begins to dissipate. If you are feeling inspired by a whole bunch of things that are unexpected as you go along, and then you can shape them and stick them in the novel, then the energy doesn't dissipate. The energy keeps going because there's a kind of a newness quality to the thing that you just thought of that you haven't thought of before that fits in a new way. And you yourself are jacked up about that. Mm-hmm. And so that energy that you feel gets into the narrative.
So I'm actually just want you to finish this sentence that comes from The Age of Grief.
Okay.
One of your characters, I'm assuming this is where the title of the book comes from, and the book is both a novella and some short stories on love, friendship, marriage. Very pertinent to a middle-aged person like myself. Dave says, I'm 35 years old, and it seems to me that I've arrived at the age of grief. So Jane Smiley, can you complete this sentence? I'm 68 years old, and it seems to me I've arrived at the age of...
acceptance. I think what happens in your mid-30s is you've spent so many years struggling to do one thing after another, whatever they are. And sometime in your early 30s, around the time you're 30, and this happens with a lot of writers, Dickens was a good example, you suddenly see the larger picture. And things sort of click into place. And for a lot of people, it doesn't look good. The things that are clicking into place are scary. And those aspirations that you had that you tricked yourself into believing were going to somehow change your life, you realize that they have not especially changed your life, or if they have, they've made your life more complicated. So there's a lot of, for me and for other people that I've known, you know, you wake up in your mid-30s and you say, oh my God, how am I going to deal with all of this complexity? And a lot of times it's having children that causes the sudden boom of complexity because they're so simultaneously beloved and hard to handle. And so you fear for them, and you fear for yourself, and you fear for the world around them in a way that you haven't in the past because you were sort of out to lunch, you know. But then the children grow up, and you grow older. And I wrote all of my saddest books in my 30s, you know. Yeah. First, there was The Age of Grief about this troubled marriage of two dentists. And then there was The Greenlanders about the end of the world, at least for those people. And then there was 1,000 Acres about, you know, horrifying things. And then I said, I just can't take this anymore, you know. And because I was teaching at Iowa State, I was fascinated by all the things that had been invented at Iowa State. And I began to see the college or a university not as a ivory tower, but as a slippery slope. Things get invented there, and then they go out into the world. And I was just fascinated by Iowa State and the idea of the land-grant university. And so I wrote Moo. Well, nobody ever loved Moo as much as I did. I laughed and laughed and laughed, and I would take passages out and read them to the family, and they'd go, huh. And I'd laugh and laugh and laugh. And so that was really a wonderful experience for me. And then I came to Horse Heaven, and I decided, okay, we're going to have 6 horses here. There's the tragic horse, the comic horse, the romantic horse, the epic horse, the realist horse, and the meta-realist horse. The meta-realist horse is the one that communicates with the animal communicator.
Yes.
And that was a lot of fun, too. And bringing them all together at the racetrack was a lot of fun, too. So my work came to the point where it reinforced my sense of pleasure about the world around me while acknowledging the pain that exists in that world. So I think that if you just keep your eyes open and get older, you'll learn to accommodate it more. The older you get, the smaller you get, because the world gets bigger and bigger and you get smaller and smaller. And the more you know, the smaller you are in your own mind. So that's a good thing too.
Jane Smiley is the author of over 24 books, ranging from young adult to comedy to tragedy to nonfiction to epic and beyond. She lives in Northern California and visited us as part of the 2017 Montana Book Festival. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin's studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.